Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. This is Brett. Today's April 23rd. Very early, very stormy Monday morning here in New Hampshire. And I'm up at 7 a.m. to throw together a podcast, really for no other purpose than to buy myself some time. I've been working on the third installment of the American Way Expanded series, and I really would like just to say thank you for all the positive feedback that I've received so far and the criticism about some of my positions on Kant and German idealism. That's all very helpful, and I will certainly try to look into some of the things that people have suggested as far as that is concerned. But I would really like to spend a few more days editing that show, making sure it's just right before I put it out. But I also like to have a new show about every 7 days, and in the very near future, I really hope to double that. And that will be the live show, which will be once a week, and then some other show that will be once a week. And a lot of exciting stuff going on. I have made some significant purchases, including a new laptop that is so far beyond what I've been using to do this show up to this point. This is probably going to be the last episode recorded on my little Mac, and then we will move to the new computer for audio, for video. It's going to help for all kinds of things once we start trying to produce a live show and have a video stream. And I was going to have Tony Myers, the guy from Tragedy and Hope, who was on the Logical Fallacies intro show. We will get to that series, too. That is coming up very soon. He offered to do a tower build for me, and I had raised some money for that project. And then this laptop deal fell in my lap, and I thought it would be good to have something that had similar capabilities but was also mobile, so I can move it, you know, from my house to Dale's studio in Manchester, and we can use it to do the live show, which will be probably half the content of the School Sucks in the future. So it made sense to have something that was mobile. I'm looking into getting a couple HD webcams, and there's some software that I actually might have to buy, if you can imagine such a thing. So that's all stuff that's coming up in the near future. The donations, the subscriptions, greatly appreciated, means so much to me. So stick around after what you hear today for new subscriber geography trivia. It's where you you say a person's name, and then you just tell a fact about where they live. It's pretty easy. But what you're going to hear is a live show. It's from about 3 weeks ago. It's me, Osborne, and Dale. April Fool's Day, a very, very loose show. I will tell you that it is not entirely about education. We do cover some educational topics because, you know, I mentioned that because this is supposedly a podcast about education. And this was going to be bonus material. But I decided that because I'd like to buy myself some time, you will hear the first hour of that show plus two additional segments. And there is a little bit of overlap, some stuff you heard in the first installment of the American Way Expanded series, but it's only about 5 minutes, and it'll give you a broader context of what we were talking about. But some of it, yes, will sound familiar. I hope that's okay. So, yeah, real loose one here, and this is definitely the kind of stuff that usually will belong in that special section of bonus material that is more about, you know, let's get a little silly. But you're going to hear that today, and hopefully that other show will be out within the next few days. And I should also mention that that show will be backlogged. It will come in the feed before this show, so that series will be 1, 2, 3, one after another in order. So make sure, wherever you're getting your podcast from, iTunes, that you check the show before this one, which will be the third part of that series, where we'll look at some actual events that led up to really World War II. I think that's where we're going to stop. I don't want to get into the huge topic of World War II. So we're just looking for the run-up. What were some of the triggers that, you know, finally set off everything that had been building up for so long in Central Europe? And, you know, interesting story, too. Another reason why I wanted to take a little bit more time with it. I got in touch with Stefan Molyneux of Free Domain Radio about a week ago, really to ask him if he could just make a time slot for me sometime in the next month. I wanted to have him on my show again. It's been over a year, maybe even 2 years, since he's been a guest or maybe a co-host on School Sucks Podcasts. So I was telling him a little bit about what I had been doing, and he said, oh yeah, you should check out my Death of the West series. And I listened to it, and there's these two voices in my head, not real voices telling me to do things, but you know, thoughts, I guess, would be a more appropriate way to describe it. One is saying, wow, this is really helpful, amazing information. This is great research. And the other voice is the podcaster voice, and it's saying, this guy beats me to everything by about 2 years, because he covers a lot of the same stuff that I talked about. Not exactly, but from some different angles. So one of the things that I wanted to do is make sure that I wasn't doing too much overlap, so I could suggest the Death of the West series in addition to what I've done with these three shows. And yeah, there might be a little bit of similar ground, but I listened to all three parts twice, and I want to try to explore some stuff that was not covered. Because, I mean, the truth is that the Death of the West series is three shows. It's about maybe 90, 100 minutes long, the whole thing. And this is a very broad subject, so there's various angles and topics to discuss and areas to explore. So I'm hoping to find some different ones, some different people, some different events, some different ideas all together. So that being said, yes, please make sure that you check back in the School Sucks podcast feed for that third show. All right, that's it. Thanks.
Oh, boy.
Historians across the country politely reminded Americans this week to quickly check and see what has happened in the past before making any big decisions.
Just take any book with history in it and then quickly skim through it to see what decisions in the past turned out to be bad. And then once you've pinpointed them, simply don't make those same decisions again. Because if a bad thing happened again, you see, that would be very bad indeed, wouldn't it?
This is the Onion News Network.
Hey everybody, and welcome back to Liberty Conspiracy Live for Sunday, April 1st. I'm Brett.
And I'm Osborne.
And Dale.
Happy April Fool's Day. Is that a thing you celebrate?
Yeah. Kind of. I try to trick people.
Did you do any good tricks?
Celebrating. I did one, but I wouldn't call it good. There's been no reaction, so.
What was your trick?
Well, on Flaming Freedom last night, we announced that we were going to support Santorum. It was kind of a last minute thing. We didn't probably do it.
I think you went too far, my friend.
Yeah. Well, we had a good explanation for it.
Did you really? What was it?
Well, the whole thing was like, then it would like get liberals anti-war again, you know, because like as long as Obama's in there promoting war, they're okay with it. And so we thought, yeah, we'll get people really upset about the state again if we get Santorum in there. And then they'll go back to being dissenters.
But they just switch back and forth because they're split each way, right? So all the people who are saying, you know, for the last 8 years when Bush was president, oh, this is turning into a police state, fascism. And then Obama got elected and they're like, whew, that was close, you know? So now
all the right wingers are now doing the same thing.
Yeah. But they'll be pacified again if whoever is elected, whatever's left of this Republican field in 2012. Yeah. Listen, I don't want this to turn into Santorum Hour. We've gotten real lazy with our show prep, Rick Santorum. We go right to Rick Santorum and say, what did he do today?
He makes it easy.
He does. He does make it very easy. And he did do something.
I'm lost. What are we talking about?
We're not talking about anything right now. Okay. I want to hear if you played any good tricks today.
No, I didn't. Although I did try to explain to my 5-year-old daughter about April Fool's Day. Mm-hmm. And so she's been running around the house all day long saying things like, you have green spots on your face. No, you don't. April Fools.
Oh, God. I've known people to do some really lame ones. I got a friend to the whole idea of fooling someone. If it's not something that's sort of unbelievable that you can go, haha, I can't believe you believe that. You're so gullible.
Yeah.
Then it's not impressive. You can always just lie to someone and say, oh no, that was just an April Fool's, but it's not very impressive.
So these were just like trivial matters that he would try to trick people with.
He tried to convince me he had some girl over and that they were both talking to us in chat or something. And it was just really lame.
Yeah, that's terrible.
Yeah. I think to do a good April Fool's, you really have to go all out and like really sell it.
You really
like,
do.
Like yeah. if I were going to do an April Fool's like, hey, everyone, I'm going gay, right? I wouldn't yeah. just say it. I would like get Dale and we just make a full on 5-minute video of us just making out and fondling each other and post it on the internet.
That might be a little bit over the top. I don't know. But you would need to like introduce people to your boyfriend. That would be.
Yeah.
Or at least we've been going out for a while and we've decided to go public about it and stop hiding. My wife knows and she understands. She's being very understanding through this, and you need to cry a little bit. And
yeah, at least put a ring on and tell people you're getting married.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, this sounds great. So
make up invitations and send them out. Yeah.
So all you people listening, you have 364 days to forget about this conversation, and next year you two, oh boy, what a doozy that'll be. All right. So I thought we would do kind of a school theme show since I was promising my audience and Gardner's audience that one day out of the five that he's on, we would have this Liberty Conspiracy School Sucks theme show where we cover school topics and found a few good ones. Anything else that's like breaking news, super important news that we should cover first?
It's the weekend. We all know that news doesn't happen on the weekend.
Sure. We usually burn this first segment anyway. It's not much for substance.
Yes, we do.
So, well, Game of Thrones is coming back.
Oh, yeah.
You guys watch
That's
that?
Actually tonight, right?
I love that.
Really? Yeah. I tried to watch, because everyone raves about it, especially our normal host, Gardner Goldsmith, loves
sure.
Game of Thrones. So I tried watching the pilot episode last season, and I thought it was the most horrible thing I've ever seen.
I'm not sure if it's enough to get hooked in just to watch the pilot episode.
What I was hooked, but I was, no. I was hooked in the first 2 minutes.
Really?
Because, like, yeah, it's like you got a lot of stuff going on.
I'm trying to remember what happened in the pilot episode. I watched the whole season, and I know what happened, but I'm trying to, what was in the pilot episode specifically?
It's not my genre, so it was interesting that I was able to get into it. But at the beginning, there's these people, and they're walking in the woods. And then these other things. Do you remember those things? Mm-hmm. What were they called? The Walkers? The White Walkers?
The White Walkers, I believe.
Whoa.
So, right? They're pretty creepy.
Real creepy. And then you don't see them again right. for the whole season. But you always get this, like, they're coming, we're building a wall, we're watching a wall kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
now, yeah. The wall is supposedly for something else. They don't, it's not for the White Walkers particularly. It's for a bunch of stuff. But it's for some more mundane threats.
Right.
I think. But then it turns out to be necessary for the White Walkers.
Well, I'm hooked in for that reason. If there is a spin-off show from this called The White Walkers, I'm totally just going to watch that. Because I'm fascinated by them. I want to know more about that.
I mean, the only thing I can tell so far is they're like zombies.
But
they're maybe, they're a little more, I don't know, they're something like zombies.
But that's a really good technique, obviously. And it's, you know, like Hitchcock and Roman Polanski, they would do that. They would not show you
mm-hmm.
the thing you want. And they would do it scene by scene, obviously, but they would not show you the thing you wanted to see. Like in, have you ever seen Rosemary's Baby?
Yes.
Mm. And there's all these shots of these weirdos in, you know, Rosemary's apartment there. And they're always just like out of frame, just a little bit. And it's almost like you want to, like you're squirming in your seat because you want to see what's going on. But just like something is hidden just a little bit. And it's very interactive that way. And Hitchcock would always, you know, do the not showing you thing. And today, the filmmaker that's probably best at it, even though he mostly sucks, is Shyamalan. Mm. Right? Not showing you things.
Right.
And it's also Shyamalan very easy
is resting on his laurels now, though.
I don't know what he does anymore.
He hasn't done anything good in a long, long time. I mean, The Sixth Sense was, I thought, one of the best movies. It was wonderful. It was a great movie.
Sure.
And he seemed right in his element. And since then, I don't think he's done anything good.
Now, I thought my favorite of his was Unbreakable.
I don't understand that at all. I thought that was hideous.
I didn't mind Signs. I thought I liked Signs.
Oh, God.
That was the one where they reveal with the alien when it walks by that walkway there. Oh, I crapped.
There's some creepy stuff in there.
There is
some creepy stuff in there, but you have to not think at all through that movie because it makes no sense. The stupidest stuff. Everyone in that movie had to be absolutely spectacularly stupid for any of it to work.
Why do you say
including
that?
The aliens themselves, the super advanced alien race that didn't, for one thing, they're invading a planet that's full of water and another deadly is what deadly to them. The planet's 3/5 water and they're invading
sure,
it.
Sure, yeah, it's a risky.
And they don't have weapons. They traveled space and they're in these spaceships and everything, and they don't have like a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just thinking they have this, you know, they're going to kill this kid. And so
maybe they were just used to throwing water on their enemies.
Maybe. So they want to kill this kid, right? And they've got like claws. They could just slit him through his throat right there. He's passed out, right?
Yeah.
But no, they use this gas that his breathing passages are blocked off conveniently. It's all part of the plot, right? Oh, it's, you know,
yeah.
A sign that there's...
Oh, it's very contrived.
It's incredibly contrived, and I couldn't get around it. It was too distracting for me. It was so contrived.
And Mel Gibson is... he's a... I don't know.
And the girl leaving glasses of water everywhere, and the aliens are vulnerable to water.
Yeah, and the whole swing away thing with, it did mean something. Come on.
And this super advanced alien is, like, trapped in a pantry. And it was just so stupid,
folks. Signs. 3 thumbs down. Liberty Conspiracy rating. Had it with that Shyamalan.
Unbreakable, seriously, that was like a whole movie of nothing happening.
I don't know, I'd like the whole, like, it's a superhero movie but like with normal people, and it's not, but it really, really a superhero movie.
It really didn't
thing. Oh, The Village.
That one sounded okay.
Other than the young lady in that movie was kind of pretty, I thought, but
I think I'm sorry, I cut you off. What were you saying about the
nothing? I said what I had to say. Okay. It's a superhero pretty story early. With normal people. I thought that was cool.
Well, I like The Village. I think that's you know, a good.
I didn't see that one. I had lost any hope and faith in Shyamalan at that point.
Yeah. Okay. You're listening to Liberty Conspiracy Live. We should give you the phone number if you want to call, 603-499-PORC. You can Skype in it in your head shows. We'll be back in a couple.
While our satellite channel is free to listen to, it's not free for us. You can help us cover our satellite costs with a chip-in on the right side of the page at lrn.fm.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to Liberty Conspiracy Live. I'm Brett.
Osborne.
And Dale.
603-499-PORC if you'd like to give us a call to chat. You can also Skype in your head shows. And I promise we would hit some school-related topics tonight. And I was scrolling through the Facebook page for School Sucks Podcast, and I came up with a few. And the one I decided to start with is called Dumb as a Rock.
Yep.
A lot of real negative language and imagery in this article. It's from something called the American Dream or the End of the American Dream.com. I don't know what that means. Dumb as a rock. You will be absolutely amazed at the things that U.S. high school students do not know. So I just wanted to kind of, I don't want to spend too much time on this article because I think this is kind of beating a dead horse, but I wanted to go over a few of them and then maybe delve into why we think this is. I mean, we live in a time where the access to information is so easy. Information is so abundant. But, you know, I always talk about how younger generations have such an advantage over older generations as far as building a way of thinking, understanding the world around them, like people who are baby boomers or, well, let's focus on baby boomers because I think that's what our parents are. Are very stuck in kind of an old way of thinking for the most part, not entirely. I don't want to generalize, but we also know that the IQ goes up pretty much generation after generation. The average IQ gets higher. But what's interesting is that 100 years ago in American public schools, so much more was expected from students than today as far as what they were expected to know and what they did know. So I wanted to talk about why that happened, but I thought first we could take a look.
Haven't literacy rates dropped dramatically over time, too?
Literacy.
Schools have been instituted?
Yeah, literacy rates were, according to John Taylor Gatto, literacy rates, at least in Massachusetts, where he was studying this, were higher before the implementation of the schooling system. So we're going back into the mid-1800s. Now, I think that there was an expectation that everyone would learn how to read, for at the very least, to read the Bible. So here we go. I'm just going to give a few of these. More than a quarter of all U.S. high school students thought that Christopher Columbus made his famous voyage across the Atlantic Ocean after the year 1750. Approximately one third. Stop it if you want to talk about any of these, because that one I think is interesting, that first one. Approximately one third of all high school students did not know that the Bill of Rights guarantees freedom of speech and freedom of religion. So first of all, I don't think the Bill of Rights actually guaranteed anything. And at least they got their language a little bit closer to right here, where they didn't say the Bill of Rights gives us.
Right. That's rights. Really that's disturbing.
That's what the school teaches, you know.
Yeah.
People say that all the time.
I guess maybe I don't understand what the word guarantee means. I mean, to me, if I'm offered a guarantee of something, that means if I don't get that thing that I'm guaranteed, then I get something else in its place.
You would have some kind of recourse.
And I guess the guarantee just means, in this case, that if I don't get freedom of speech and freedom of religion, I just get a massive police state instead.
You get one of these.
Yeah.
I just flipped him off. If you're listening at home, yeah. But I didn't mean it. I'm just, that's what he gets from them.
It was an April Fool's flip off.
Maybe the Bill of Rights is an April Fool's joke.
I think it was.
Only 60% of all U.S. students knew that World War I was fought sometime between
1900 and 1950.
I'm just reloading the page here real quick.
So they're not being really picky with these dates. They're not making them nail a date.
No, and you know
just
what?
Just get the gist of it.
I'm not thinking that this is the worst problem, that people don't know dates. Now, I mean, if you're off by half a century,
if you're way off, then contextually it changes it a lot. If you don't have the basic gist of it,
yeah,
then because like these different wars, the world wars, there are factors in them that affected the next world war and things like that. So,
but that's causality, and they don't get any of that anyway.
Right. I guess
Things are very divided up. So like there's really, I mean, I remember I was in college when I was learning like Western Civ 2, when you're learning about the connections between World War I and World War II, and you're like, wow, who would have thought? You know, because none of that was not apparent in school. Right. And I mean, most of this stuff is so boring in school that a lot of kids aren't even paying attention anyway. They could care less about this. They become resistant to the idea of enlightenment in general because it's always attached to this forced schooling, and it just becomes very unappealing, unattractive.
Very dry, regimented.
Yeah, absolutely. What is the supreme law of the land? 28%. What is the supreme law?
This is just a list of some questions in the percentage of people that answered it correctly.
I would have said the Constitution.
Yeah, I guess that's what they're pushing on this website too.
That would be my guess for that question. But.
What do we call the first 10 amendments to the Constitution? 26%. What are the two parts of the U.S. Congress? 27%. How many justices in the Supreme Court? 10%. Who wrote the Declaration of Independence? 14%. What ocean is on the east coast of the United States? 61%. Who are the two major political parties? 43%.
What?
That's,
really?
What's surprising about that?
Oh, it gets pounded into our heads constantly on TV and everything.
Sure. But I talk to a lot of young people in what I do for work, and a lot of them, I ask them, are you required to do any kind of like exploration of current events? Do you guys talk in your history class, your government class, or economics, or whatever version of social studies that you're taking in school? Do you guys talk about anything that goes on in the world? And a lot of kids tell me no. They don't cover any of this stuff. So...
All right. I'm just surprised they don't glean it from just this. Yeah. I mean, if they're watching television, I don't know. But maybe they're not watching the stuff that's talking about this. There's
somebody told me
avoiding it watching American Idol.
Somebody told me they talked about Coney 2012. Somebody came in to shirt. So they're
great marketing.
Yeah. Yeah. Somebody came in with a shirt on. So there was a big conversation about Coney 2012.
So I'd like to point out that all these questions are fairly technical questions about the workings of the government.
Yeah. Right?
And why does anyone need to know that? How does that affect my life today? How many Supreme Court justices there are?
It doesn't.
They want these kids to to feel like it's that they're involved with that and that they have a say in it, that it's their government, that it's the government by the people and for the people and so forth. Right. So,
well, they're doing a crappy job important. Of it since only 10%
exactly.
know the answer.
Well, yeah, this is,
but this is what they consider important, is that they feel a part of it, and that they, because that's part of the whole thing about convincing you that this is legitimate, that it's, that it works for you and that it's not just manipulating people.
Right. Sure.
So we should be happy that they're not getting this information through to these kids that they care about getting through to them.
Why is that?
Why do you really want kids running around really thinking that they have a voice and they're important with regard to this political process?
I think that you know, if you're trying to protect prey from a predator, they should at least know that the predator exists. Now, obviously, school is putting a cage around the prey, you know, and waiting for the, so they're ready for the predator pretty much.
I'd be curious, the kids that are involved in Ron Paul's campaign, I'd be curious how well they do on a lot of this stuff. I bet they'd be surprisingly better.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. This is Liberty Conspiracy, 603-499-PORC. We've got room for your call, so go ahead and make it. We'll be back. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Liberty Conspiracy Live. I'm Brett.
And Osborne.
And Dale.
Liberty Conspiracy is on LRN FM, .FM, excuse me, Sunday through Thursday, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, if you're tuning in for the first time tonight. Usually the host is a guy named Gardner Goldsmith, and we are filling in for him tonight. He's at a horror convention, right?
Yes, the World Horror Convention in Salt Lake City.
I'm jealous. I would love to be there.
Well, I think that would be very cool.
I think next year, let's take a trip all together.
I might be up for that. I mean, if we can, especially if we can consolidate things and to, you know, share expenses in a way to make it affordable.
I'm pretty sure last year they had it at South by Southwest. That would have been a good time, I feel.
What's that?
That's like this massive... it's not just a movie festival, it's like an everything cultural festival in Austin, Texas.
When I was living in L.A., I had a friend drag me to the Fangoria Weekend of Horrors in Burbank several years in a row, and that was, I had a fun time at that.
But that would be fun.
That was a very small thing. It was just like one big conference room.
Maybe once,
not a conference room, I'm sorry, but yeah.
Maybe once Chartarum is done, we'll be able to take a trip.
That'd be awesome. Well, yeah, I mean, that'd be really cool.
For those of you who may have forgotten or never knew, Dale and I made a zombie movie a couple years ago, and it still has yet to be released. But
it's coming soon. Yeah, you made it, and I was in it. You and John Shaw made it.
Yeah, John Shaw mostly made it, but we participated, Dale and I.
And I've a nice seen, part. I liked my part. That was a lot of
yes,
fun.
Yes, Dale's actually the star of the movie.
I was the scream queen.
Yeah.
Hey, it was really cool. It just kind of happened during the movie. John saw, I was like, wait, we don't have a scream queen. All right, Dale, you're the scream queen.
Scream queen. Say that five times fast.
Yeah, okay. I screwed it up already.
Okay.
So basically the plot of the movie is that you guys are zombies and you're trying to get into somebody's house, but they've planted all of these plants that shoot pea pods at you, and it just makes like the most kind of, the worst kind of
that
trouble.
That could be a movie.
Yeah, it should be. I'd like to point out that Battleship is coming out this year.
Oh!
A movie based on the Milton Bradley game.
I can't imagine what the point of that would be.
I gotta believe that Plants vs. Zombies would make a better movie than that.
I think that would be a great movie.
I would watch it.
I can't wait for Iron Skies.
Holy crap, dudes. Last night I watched Tucker and Dale versus Evil.
I want to see that.
Have you ever seen that?
No, I want to have a movie night.
It's on Netflix. Download it. It's a cabin in the woods horror movie, completely turned on its head, and it is hilarious.
I can't wait to see that. I'm all set to watch that. I want to do a movie night or something and watch that.
All right.
So one thumb up.
There were a lot of things.
Dale and Tucker versus Evil.
There were a lot of stuff, and there were a lot of things in there. The spoofing of horror movies that they were doing that it was a little frustrating because we did. I think we were spoofing horror movies with when we wrote. Slaughter in the Haunted Forest, which we haven't shot, but we wrote the script for Slaughter in the Haunted Forest. There's a lot of spoofing of horror movie cliches in there. Mm. And so when I saw Tucker and Dale versus Evil, I just saw the trailer for it. I'm like, they're spoofing a lot of the same things we were. Not necessarily in exactly the same way, very, very different way, but there was a lot of, I was seeing a lot of some of the same ideas there, and that was frustrating because we had just written a script, you know.
I'm also very excited for Cabin in the Woods. Coming out in 2 weeks. It's a Joss Whedon film.
That should be
it's
cool.
It's supposed to be quite excellent.
Have you seen Cabin Fever?
No.
Oh my God, that's a classic. You got to see Cabin Fever.
Yes, I will.
What's the storyline for Cabin in the Woods?
I don't know.
Really?
I just know it's Joss.
That's all you need.
Yeah, that's all I need. Yeah. Sure.
It's Joss Whedon.
So we've been covering this story so far. Well, not really a story, kind of an expose on the dumbification, as it's being called in this article, of this generation of public school students. And like I said, I didn't feel like we needed to get too into these percentages of this sort of trivial information that students may or may not know. But I did want to share one more part of the article here. It's just a quote from I think somebody talking to a teacher. The following is from an article written by reporter Mark Morford, in which he described his conversations with a longtime Oakland high school teacher that was nearing retirement. It's gotten so bad. This is from the story. It's gotten so bad that my friend nears retirement, he is very seriously considering moving out of the country so as to escape what he sees will be the surefire collapse of functioning American society in the next handful of years due to the absolutely irrefutable destruction, the shocking and nearly hopeless dumbification of the American brain. It's just that bad. Now, you may think he's merely a curmudgeon, a tired old teacher who stopped caring long ago. Not true. Teaching is his life. He says he loves his students, loves education and learning and watching young minds awaken. Problem is, he is seeing much less of it. Later on in the same article, Morford tells us that the high school teacher even admitted that very few of his students even know how to put a sentence together. It gets worse. My friend cites that of the 6,000 high school students he estimates he's taught over the span of his career, only a small fraction now make it to his grade with a functioning understanding of written English. They do not know how to form a sentence. They cannot write an intelligible paragraph. Recently, after giving an assignment that required drawing lines, he realized that not a single student actually knew how to use a ruler.
To draw a line? A straight line?
Yeah.
Now, well, technically, isn't drawing a straight line with a ruler an improper use of tools? Because isn't a ruler meant to be used for measuring?
No, I'd say, well, we call it a straight edge.
Oh, I see.
When we're talking about the line drawing.
I think drawing lines is part of the measuring process. You want to draw a line of a certain length. And
okay, I know that I do, but I'm just trying to get a little technical.
What about a protractor? Can you imagine them? All right, draw a circle of so-and-so radius.
Oh, my goodness, kids would be getting stabbed. Those things were sharp.
They were.
Yeah.
They were. What do they use now? They've got some kind of safety protractor. I'm sure they would never give that to a child now. That would get confiscated at the metal detector at the front door.
Oh my, yeah, it'd be a weapon. Zero tolerance, Dale. Yeah. Zero tolerance.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Who has not been stabbed with a protractor at some point? Or just stabbed yourself trying to use it?
I have.
When I was in kindergarten, brutal.
Why did they have to be that sharp?
Really? They were sharp. To pierce the paper. When you were in kindergarten.
When I was in kindergarten, I stabbed someone through the hand with a pencil.
Really?
Just throwing that out there for the listeners.
Were you upset with him, or was it an accident?
I don't even remember it. I was just told this story. Evidently,
oh, my God.
Evidently,
I'm a little scared of you now, Jason.
Evidently, he did something to me first, like hit me or something like that. And
I bet he didn't again.
I stabbed him through the hand. No,
I bet he didn't bother you after that.
I imagine that is the case.
I think I hit a kid once around that age.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it happens.
I managed to avoid violence for the most part through, I'm even times when, other than being like shoved around a little, for the most part, I avoided getting into fights and things like that.
Yeah, no,
I pointedly avoided them because I didn't want to get into a fight.
I think when this happened, I had to go, I was very, very young, and I just have like very slight foggy memory of this, but it's probably in kindergarten, and I hit a kid, I don't remember why, and then I was taken to the principal's office. And I was asked by the principal to draw her some pictures of rabbits. So, lesson learned.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's
what I remember about it.
I bet in context it made sense.
Yeah. Now, of course, that could be some memory that I just invented to repress something far more terrible. I don't know. That didn't even have to.
Maybe he actually asked you to draw pictures of penises.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
What do rabbits represent to you, Brett? What memory have you suppressed with rabbits?
Penises. Nailed it. We got it. We figured it out. Thanks, Dale. That was easy. That was easy. Wow. Therapy
they do,
radio.
They do reproduce a lot. I won't go into rabbit trivia that I just learned today, if you don't want me to.
Oh, now I kind of do want you to.
You brought it up.
A pair of rabbits, I've heard, within the span of like 3 years, their offspring, they could produce 33 million offspring or something like that. Two rabbits within 3 years.
Really?
And the reason they don't, the reason why rabbits don't, the reason we're not flooded with rabbits, because 90% of their babies are eaten by predators.
Wow, good thing, huh?
Yeah.
Liberty Conspiracy Live. Give us a call, 603-499-PORC. Skype in your head shows. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Liberty Conspiracy. I'm Brett.
And I'm Osborne.
And Dale.
And we've been covering this article. I want to give you the title of it, and you can look it up. It's on endoftheamericandream.com, I believe. And the title was...
Dumb as a Rock.
You will be absolutely amazed at the things U.S. high school students do not know.
And so, I myself am not amazed.
No, I'm not amazed at all.
No.
And I see kids, we also have sort of the trivial nature of these facts that they're using. And of course, they're judging what the schools are doing by the school's own metrics, because these are the things that you would be expected to know when you graduate from high school. Because it doesn't deal with concepts, it doesn't deal with ideas, it doesn't deal with making connections, it doesn't deal with causality. It deals with a bunch of seemingly unconnected facts that are regurgitated onto a test. So... at the beginning, I was talking about, well, why is this? If there's such easy access to information today, why is so much less expected of young people? I mean, if you look at a test, we did this, John Kurtz and I, when I was on his show a few months back, we got a test from like the 1890s. And the things that eighth graders were expected to know were things that I don't think adults know how to do today. Certainly, I don't think most college kids would know a lot of this information today. So what happened? Well, one theory is that because the school engenders this sense of dependence, of helplessness over time, generation after generation, I believe that less has come to be expected of each new crop of students. But you guys had some other thoughts on that as well. Dale, you were saying...
I want to... expound on that a little. You're right. I think there really is this tendency over time to keep people in a childlike state later and later and later. And that I think there's part of that's an overprotectiveness. There's crossing guards for high school students.
Yeah.
How ridiculous is that? They don't think a high school student is yet able to cross the street safely.
Well, sure, but school is a jobs project too.
Yeah.
Know, where. There's all this money to come and take, so...
But the notion of calling someone a child well into their adulthood, and there's the tendency even to call, we say college kids.
Mm-hmm.
Once people are in college, they're adults.
Yeah.
They are adults, but they're not treated like it. And there is that sense of keeping them in a childlike state to control them, I think, also. And to a large extent, we're kept in a childlike state forever, with the government being the nanny.
Absolutely.
The nanny state, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's part of it.
So school is great preparation for citizenship. That's sure. For sure.
Yeah.
And before we get into the unions thing, because I think that might be kind of a big topic, Osborne, can you tell us a little bit what you were saying about what we were talking
Yeah, a couple of things. Yeah. I think the explanation they try to give oftentimes of why people don't know these facts that kids used to know back in the 1800s is there's just so much more information now.
Yeah.
So how could they be expected to know a smaller subset of information so well when there's such a greater set of information from which they can draw upon?
Right.
And but as far as the dumbification of people, just in my biased view as a mathematician, kids are not taught how logic works in school. And the reason for that, I suppose we could speculate as to the conspiracies and what have you. But kids not being able to form paragraphs, kids not being able to perform mathematical functions, all of those kind of things are derived from the fact that they don't, at their core, understand the principles of logic.
So they're pretty much helpless, and like they're waiting to be told what to do. They're waiting to be given instructions at every step because they don't have a foundation of knowledge where they immediately – they have a process or they have a set of tools that allows them to confidently approach a new problem and say, well, I have to work out – I have to figure out how to do this based on simpler skills that I already know. And I run into this all the time on the SAT, which for the math is a very logic-based test. It's complex problem solving. It's using – multiple concepts together. And kids are frustrated because they look at some of these problems and they say, I've never seen anything like this before. There's no way I could do this. I don't know what formula I would use. Find the area of a sector of a circle. No one ever gave me a formula for area of a sector of a circle. You know, so it's like they stall out right at the beginning because there's no one there telling them what to do. Now, this isn't all kids, but these are problems. I hate to say it, and I hate to talk about young people who I think are potentially brilliant and in the things that they're interested in, might show that brilliance now. But when it comes to thinking, I run into this again and again, and I'm not like, it doesn't make me happy to mention this stuff, but it's true. So can you give us an example of how that would work, maybe like having this understanding and how that could be applied?
No, not on the spot. Sorry.
Well, I think it would be what I would think if I were a teacher, what I would be trying to convey to my students is I would try to take, for instance, a period in history and get them to think about what were the people at the time thinking that caused them to behave in the way that they did at that time. Maybe read, combine some of the literature that was written at that time, read that, and get a context for what was going on at the time and why things were happening the way they were happening. I don't think things like that are they're just being taught dates and people who did certain things and factoids, like you said. Yeah. There are things like that, and that goes into critical thinking and being able to apply something, the idea that if we fail to learn from history, we're condemned to repeat it, things like that. If someone saw, for instance, if you talk about I would be curious, for instance, if someone talks about Anne Frank, and if a teacher ever gets someone to consider, can you imagine a case where your government might be doing something corrupt and you would be actually protecting a fugitive from government?
Sure.
And might that be the moral thing to do? But can you imagine a modern school teaching even breaching such a subject?
I think it would reveal, like, understanding, like, what are the motivations? What is the zeitgeist at the time? What are people feeling? What were they thinking? What were they being told? What ideologies were they embracing? I think that's all very, very dangerous territory for government school because it could reveal a lot of the sort of under-the-surface corruption, you know, the philosophic corruption of society. Like, why did people support slavery? Why do people accept war? What was the situation in Germany? How did they go for all of that? And if you understand what was underneath and how much of that translates directly into our society, into our thinking today, it's just very dangerous. So instead of, you know, looking at the gasoline-soaked house, because so much of history is bad news, right? And a lot of, like, it's the spotlight on bad people doing horrific things while good people stand by and do nothing or cheer them on. So in the case of like these wars in the first half of the 20th century, it's like this tossing of matches onto a gasoline-soaked house. And then they step back and they say, well, clearly this house reduced to a pile of ashes was caused by three matches. you know, and that's not what reduced right. the house. To, but we talk about the economic system in Germany, the rhetorical skills of Adolf Hitler. This is not...
Pearl Harbor is like yeah. the gasoline-soaked house before the...
Well, the gasoline-soaked house was their ideology, was their education system, was the way they treated...
Oh, I'm sorry, when I was meeting, like Pearl Harbor was like a match.
Right? Yeah, Pearl Harbor was like the match.
When there was so much going on before that that is glossed over.
So if you learn about World War I in school, you would think it was when some Serbian anarchist assassinated Archduke Ferdinand, and this started a war. I mean, and you know so little about causal relationships that this makes sense. That goes back to what Osborne was saying about logic, that immediately someone would say, stop.
And how World War I was already setting up World War II. And
right,
that, yeah.
right. But the fact that such a small event, the assassination of an Austrian nobleman, could start one of the most ghastly, destructive, horrific wars in history... Like, something is missing there. You know what I mean? So, like, that's a match. You know, where... Let's look at, like, the explosives and the gasoline and the incendiaries and the accelerants. All that stuff is missing. All that is missing from the
context.
Story.
It's really a lot... Again, context. And critical thinking and analysis of what exactly was going on and why did that match set off a huge fire?
But they can't know that. Because then they would very easily be able to make connections between then and now and say, wait a minute, we still believe that.
Yeah.
This is Liberty Conspiracy Live, 603-499-PORC. We're doing a little school edition, and we're also talking about movies and rabbits, and you can call in and bring up whatever you like. 603-499-PORC, Skype in your head shows. Welcome back to Liberty Conspiracy Live for Sunday night. I'm Brett.
I'm Osborne.
And Dale.
This is hour two of the show, so that means we've got a whole hour to take your phone calls. Our number is 603-499-PORC. If you want to call us using Skype, In Your Head Shows is how you do that. That's our name on Skype. So we've covered this article about, the dumbing down or the continued dumbing down. I think that was the system's intention from the beginning. And we covered a couple different reasons for that. I talked about that this is progressive over time. With each generation, there's going to be more dependence, less self-sufficiency. And obviously, that's going to result in a diminished curriculum, even with compared to what the school started with. Osborne brought in the logic piece that I think it's not even needing to. So maybe like logic is a science. It could be a whole college course, but human beings are naturally logical. I think we want to remove contradictions. We want to understand things in a way that makes them functional, that makes us useful. And that's school certainly schooled out of us. But another aspect of that we wanted to cover, and we're about to go to a phone call, is the unions. And our caller, Greg, is actually in Madison, Wisconsin, where that whole big union thing went down about half a year ago. Greg, are you there?
Hey, is this Brett?
Yes.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Great. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing just fine. I listened to your podcast. I've been listening since the beginning, actually, and it's the first time calling into any of your shows. So this is actually my first time listening to the show, though. So you guys are doing a great job, though.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks. And I appreciate that. Yeah. Thanks for listening to School Sucks. So what did you want to talk about tonight?
Well, I just wanted to say, I live in Madison right now, so that's happening right now. And you guys are talking about methods of indoctrination, I guess, besides, drawing rabbits and penises, for the teachers and all that. There is another method that I was wondering if you guys wanted to talk about a little bit, and
sure.
That's the use of songs, actually, in school.
Did you say songs?
Songs. Well, you think about it, you got general music education in a lot of the public schools. that I see. And I can, I'm just thinking back to that, you see, you know, like I remember doing all these Columbus songs, and we had songs for, you know, all the holidays, like Memorial Day, Veterans Day, President's Day. We had huge President's Day things. We did concerts, you know, so like all different kinds of, you know, like government songs. You know, you learned ways, you know, that's how you, that's a way of retaining information, I guess. And it's been used going back to the medieval era. To just really as a way of retaining information. That's a great way, as scientists, you know, to say, if you are looking to learn a language even, you know, making up a song to remember the prepositions or this tense, this gender case, that sort of thing. It's a great way to use to get that information kind of in your head, is to learn through a song or as a mnemonic device, I guess.
I got to say, Greg, this is such an astute observation. Like, I can't believe I've never covered this on my show. It makes perfect sense that at least in the case of indoctrination, and I think that's what you're kind of hinting at here. Am I correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's even more prevalent now, I think, in these union battles in Madison. I can't tell you how many times I go up. You know, I live downtown, actually, so I'm pretty close to the Capitol where all these protests take place a lot. And,
yeah.
You have these, we have what's called the Capitol Singers. And this is, these aren't just, you know, chants, you know, they're doing the, you know, another way of getting, you know, a message in your head is, you know, to say, down with Walker, whatever their chant is.
This is what democracy looks like.
That's it.
It's democracy, not hypocrisy, right? They say democracy. Okay.
Yeah. And so they have the Capitol Singers, and they've been performing, I think, every. They go into the Wisconsin Capitol, I think, recently shut them down, at least for periods, you know, when they're in session or whatever. But they go in and they've written these songs, and that's how they perform them.
And I've seen videos of them getting kids to sing them too. Like, so again, it's this new pro union pledge of allegiance as far as the thought that has to go into it, as far as the chanter is concerned, right? Because they don't know what they're saying. They don't know what they're supporting. Their teacher hands them a piece of paper or leads them in a chant. I've seen videos of it in the rotunda of the Wisconsin the Capitol building in Madison. I remember being a graduate student in college and having this one professor. And we would sing in the class. I wouldn't sing, but she would lead the class in like these 1920s union songs about solid union solidarity. And I've said several times, I don't have a problem with collective bargaining in the private sector, but. You know, so that was an interesting experience that I had when I was maybe 19 or no, at this time when I was in graduate school, I was like 23. And this is what was going on. So you're right. Now that I think about it, all I remember doing in elementary school was singing one thing or another. How about you guys?
Yep.
I have no recollection of singing songs in school. I know definitely at churches and other religious institutions, they love to push the singing.
Well, I joined a chorus in my senior year in high school, but other than that.
No, we're talking, Greg, do you remember, like, you'd say the Pledge of Allegiance, maybe, because this was my experience, and tell me if you had this too. You'd sing the Pledge of Allegiance, say the Pledge of Allegiance, and then you would sing a song. That's how we did it in my school. We would sing, "You're a Grand Old Flag."
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember I learned that. We didn't sing it every day, but we learned all those old patriotic songs.
Yeah.
And I remember my music teacher, you know, went through and she broke down each meaning and, you know, it was what's the one with Amber Waves of Granite? I can't remember which one song that is, but
Purple Mountain Majesty, America the Beautiful.
Purple Mountain Majesty. I mean, she went through all these poetic devices and, I'm sure, you know, she didn't realize what she was doing. She's just, you know, she's been doing this method for years and that's what she was instructed to by her educating professors in college, I'm sure, but. She said, you know, they said this is how you get kids to learn about stuff, is to sing educational songs about being a good citizen and all that kind of good stuff. And so she, of course, she would take, you know, the classic ones, the Purple Mountain Majesties, and, you know, go through the poetic devices, all the great images, and, you know, fill kids with wonderful thoughts about how great this this little land of ours is. So. I do remember those in the general music course that I took, it's not a course, I didn't volunteer to take it. You know, we got shuttled off to music class halfway through the day, but Yeah. So that's what I remember about those kinds of songs. But I mean, Pledge Every Day is the other example. I still know it, so can't get it out of my head.
Yeah, and that's a real subtle but definitely, in my opinion, an example of an emotional attack. I've been working on this series, kind of the backstory of the rise of Nazism and how that happened through the schools and society in, you know, Prussia and then unified Germany in the latter half of the 1800s and then the Weimar Republic. And it seems like at some point, and this happens for us in elementary school, the country, the people, the land, and the state all kind of bond together into this one paternal entity. And
I've
I
got a story about the pledge too when you're done.
Sure, sure. So, Greg, before we let you go, can you just tell us a little bit about, you mentioned these Capitol Singers, what's going on there on the ground in Madison? Are people still after Walker? Is that still a big thing? Because we haven't seen much about it in the media, and I know it caught on in other states as well, but people real still active there? They still have their tent cities and all that?
Well, I'm a graduate student here actually right now. It feels bad because I'm talking about this stuff. I'm studying musicology, music history, that kind of thing. So that's why it's a topic that interests me. But you will go to the Capitol all the time, just you know, for lunch or something like that as a group. And of course, they'll always be out. It's mostly what it is now. Is you just have these little groups that are, you know, sticking around and that sort of thing. I can tell you, like, around campus though, which is, you know, a hop, skip, a dip away from the Capitol. The people on the side are, you know, they're not signing petitions anymore. They're not really talking about it that much. It's not until the election, pretty much, that they're going to start getting into it. So I think it's pretty much that down until the election.
Well, Greg, thank you so much for your call. That's great information. This is Liberty Conspiracy. We will be right back. Everybody, welcome back to Liberty Conspiracy Live for Sunday, April 1st. Remember that you can check out this show all week long, starting today, ending on Thursday, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on LRN.fm. And go to LRN.fm and check out all the other great programming that's on that network, including my show, School Sucks Podcast. And Dale, you've got a show.
FlamingFreedom.com.
So anyway, I'm Brett.
And I'm Osborne.
And Dale.
And we've covered a variety of different topics tonight. I tried to anchor it around education, but we've gone here and there, and that's fine. We just had a great call from a listener named Greg out in Wisconsin, and he was telling us about the role that music plays in indoctrination. I think that's fascinating. Like I said, that's totally something I should do a show about.
I have to tell you my school pledge or the Pledge of Allegiance story.
Sure, sure.
So I'm ask the caller, hold on for just a moment longer. I think I was in fourth grade, and I'm estimating, but I think it was fourth grade, and I would say the pledge every day after they played the anthem over the intercom. They'd play the national anthem, and then we'd do the pledge. We'd say it all in unison. It was kind of creepy. how it is. It's a little creepy. But I would say it. I didn't really think of it as being creepy at the time. It was just something we had to do, so I did it. And at some point there was I think we were asked to say it by ourselves. They were testing us on it. If we actually knew the pledge, because when everyone's saying it together, you can't really tell if someone doesn't know it. And I wasn't able to. I couldn't get it to come back to me. And I was saying it every day, just fine. I could say it rote after the pledge, after the anthem played every day. It was just like a rote thing. I would say it. I was in a trance almost.
Interesting.
And it was just rote, right? And I was trying to explain to the teacher, this is the dead honest truth. I was trying to explain to the teacher, I can say it after the anthem plays, I can say it. And I could. It was in my subconscious or something. I don't know. I could not do it on demand like that. But I said, I have to hear the Pledge of Allegiance first, and then I can say it. Or not the Pledge of Allegiance. I'm sorry. I can hear the anthem first, and then I can say it. But it just goes to show that I didn't have any clue what it meant. The words themselves were just sounds practically. Yeah. It was just a rote thing that had been pounded into my head, and I could do it like a rat going through a maze.
So after what, that, did they... Oh, go ahead, Jason.
I was just going to say, that makes sense to me, right? Because how many times when you're driving around in your car, you're singing along with Sweet Caroline or what have you.
Right.
But then you get up on a stage and someone says, now sing Sweet Caroline right now.
No.
Like, you don't know what those words are.
Right.
Even though you sing along in your car every single day.
There's some part of your brain that can do that task. It's almost like muscle memory.
Right.
Because you've done it so much, you can do it absentmindedly without thinking about it, just like you're fixing your breakfast in the morning or whatever it is you do, and you can be thinking about something else completely, and your hands are just going through the motions. Well, my mouth was going through the motions of the Pledge of Allegiance.
Right. So. And this is just like how they teach math in the public schools and why you give someone a problem to solve and they can't solve it because it doesn't fit this narrow apparatus that was constructed for them to solve the problems in the classroom.
Yeah, absolutely. See, my school was different. Everything we did was on like this electrified mat. And if we did something wrong, we'd get a shock. But if we did something right, we could push a button and get a food pellet. That's the Skinner box, everybody. And that's what school is. It's operant conditioning. And I think that's what we're all describing. So, Dale, we got somebody on the phone?
We do. We have, believe it's Mike.
Yep, Mike down in New York. I think we've heard from him before. Mike, how you doing?
Yes, how are you guys?
Good. You've called in before, right?
Yes, I called one other time with, what was it? Oh, I forgot the name of it. That experiment with Stanley Milgram.
Yeah, that's right.
Milgram, that was it. Yeah, I forgot the name of it. Anyway, did anybody catch the Molyneux and Jan Irving YouTube video?
No. Wow, that actually sounds interesting. I'd like to hear a little bit about it.
Yeah, it was pretty good. They talked about a bunch of different, you know, the normal subjects. Then eventually they were in an argument over money. Jan was arguing that. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that's what I've argued with Jan Irvin about in the past too. In fact, I think there's one of my shows where we do the Origins of Money roundtable, and we got into a little bit too on the history of money and the meaning of money and what should happen going forward with respect to money. So go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, Jan was arguing that. A state didn't really matter as far as domination of a currency, and Steph was arguing that the state is a monopoly on currency, so there wouldn't be a monopoly in a free market, and that's basically how the argument was going. Yeah.
You know, if it wasn't important for the state to have a monopoly on the money, then why do they have it? Right.
Yeah.
Oh, it's important because. I mean that's their. I mean that's if you have power over the money, you have, you're God, you know.
Sure. Well, I want to hear it before I make any conclusions because I know Jan is a pretty. I mean, I don't agree with him on this issue, but he is a pretty studied guy, and I know he's always learning new stuff. So I'm interested to hear what he has to say. I don't know how much my positions will change. But, I know that people from that Tragedy and Hope community that you can see a bunch of different podcasts over there, mine included at tragedyandhope.com. They have been doing a little bit of crossover with, people you might be more familiar with from LRN.FM, which I think is a very good thing. Stefan Molyneux was on the Corbett Report with James Corbett, who's in Japan, and he's sort of a media analyst, and he does a very good show out there. So that's something that I would also recommend. And anything else, Mike, on that? Anything else that was interesting to you about that, or anything entirely different that you'd like to talk about?
well, I think Jan had a few good points on what he was saying. Could a single entity dominate the monetary business without a government? I think it's within the realms of possibility in a perfectly free market, I guess, especially with money, because it's pretty much whoever has the best product would probably dominate it, because it'd be easier than exchanging monies. And
so we're talking about a market monopoly on some kind of in a world of competitive currencies. Somebody developing a market monopoly.
Well, monopolies are much more difficult without assistance from the state, right? It's not that they cannot happen for any length of time. They might happen. But if they got really If I think the argument is often made that if you have a monopoly with absent the state, absent the violence of the state, it's not necessarily a horrible thing. It means they're doing an excellent job and no one's really terribly upset with them. But as soon as anyone does get upset with them and if they don't have the violence at their disposal, then someone can very quickly come in and snatch their shares, the market shares away from them.
Sure.
Well, the definition of monopoly really depends on the specificity of the product that you're talking about. I have a monopoly on Osborne semen. I don't have a monopoly on all semen production in the entire world.
Oh, well, we can dream. This is Liberty Conspiracy Live, 603-499-PORC. Skype in your head shows. We're here till midnight Eastern. And the rest of that show will be in the bonus content section of the new website. Some very interesting things happen, including a debate between Dale and Osborne that runs beyond the show. We wound up doing half-hour after show as well so they could continue their discussion. And we even took some phone calls while we were off the air. So in the bonus content section, you will be able to hear the rest of that in the near future. Now, on School Sucks Podcast, we have this little thing we like to do called
New Subscriber Geography Trivia. You just say a person's name and they tell a fact about where they live.
Okay, we've got quite a list here. Let's start with Claire, who is in Montreal, one of my favorite cities. Love Montreal. Used to go there a lot when I was younger. And, well, what can I tell you about it? No, first of all, Claire is not a new subscriber. Actually, just upgraded to a higher level of subscription, which is, of course, greatly appreciated, and I thought it was worth mentioning here. So, did you know that during the Civil War, Montreal was a real hub for Confederate activity and sympathy? John Wilkes Booth spent 10 days in Montreal meeting with the Confederate Secret Service just 6 months before Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. Also has the second highest number of restaurants per capita in North America. Montreal. I highly recommend a visit. And next we have Ryan, who is in Eugene, Oregon. And Eugene, while I was doing some research on that city, I went to its Wikipedia page, and I was surprised to see one of the headings read anarchism. So I wanted to share that with you real quick. During the 1990s and early years of the first decade of the 21st century, Eugene contained a community of anarchists situated in the Whitaker neighborhood of West Eugene. This community gained international notoriety in 1999 due to its perceived role in the protests at the WTO conference in Seattle that year. Following these protests, then-Mayor Jim Tory described the city as, quote, the anarchist capital of the United States. What kind of anarchists were these? Well, let's read on. The Eugene anarchist movement grew out of the tree sits and forest defense camps of the 1990s. Demonstrations and riots in Eugene have since occurred, notably during a Reclaim the Streets event on June 18, 1999, when protesters blocked downtown streets and smashed the windows of three stores. Some rioters threw stones and bottles at police. That's too bad. One notable set of events in Eugene's anarchist community history was the Mud People's Protest. On that day, the participants noticed two blocks of trees in a parking lot near a downtown area were slated for removal the following Sunday. The ensuing tree-sitting protest on June 1, 1997 was reported widely as it lasted several hours before the crowd became violent and the police responded with pepper spray. So that's too bad that anarchism gets that kind of a reputation because of people like these. But, you know, extra thanks to Ryan for finding the time and the resources to donate to School Sucks Podcast while living in the middle of an eco-terrorist war zone. So thank you again, Ryan. And one more. Eugene was the first city in America to have one-way streets. How about that? That's where traffic can only go in one direction, Eugene, Oregon. And next we have John. He is in O'Fallon, Illinois. It's actually the birthplace of the actor William Holden. And if you're young, you might not know who that is, but he has been in some of my favorite movies of all time, including Sunset Boulevard, The Bridge on the River Kwai, and Network, which I actually just rewatched within the last couple months. William Holden, he was born there in 1918. By the way, if you've never seen Network, 1976 film, directed by Sidney Lumet, very, very prophetic look at the television media in this country, and great cast. In addition to Holden, it has Peter Finch, Robert Duvall, and a young Faye Dunaway, who people thought she was very attractive. I always thought she kind of had a bit of a skeleton face, but I could see how other people would find her attractive. She's, you know, tall and thin and shapely, and if you're into that. So the Network actually contains one of the most quotable moments in movie history, when the news anchor, who's learned he's just lost his job and he's got nothing else to lose, so he decides basically he's going to start injecting some truth and some meaning into the nightly newscast. And this is the whole "I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore" speech. Network. You got to see it. Great movie. So that's O'Fallon. And next we have Stoyan, who is in Varna, Bulgaria. Now, I don't know what to do with Varna, because this is an area that has a very rich history, and a lot of things happened there, going all the way back like 1,000 years to the Crusades. This is also a location of a lot of activity during World War I and the Balkan Wars. It actually fell under communist rule. Oh, you know, I will tell you about one very interesting thing that happened in Varna twice, and that is the rhythmic gymnastics competition. You're saying, Brett, what is that? Rhythmic gymnastics is where individuals or teams get together, and in synchronicity, they try to manipulate objects in this kind of dance performance. Very interesting. It's like synchronized swimming with no water. So that's the rhythmic gymnastics. I believe it was in the 60s and the 80s that Varna played host to the World Rhythmic Gymnastics competition. That is probably the most trivial fact that I could have produced about this place that, like I said, has an incredible history. And I'm always really happy when I get donations or positive feedback, really any feedback at all, from somebody who lives in a place that just 20 years ago seemed like such a different and disconnected world from where I am in the United States. In fact, one time the city where Stoyan lives was actually named Stalin. I think that lasted for about 20 years. And that was after who else but Joseph Stalin. So, you know, worlds apart at one time, joined together today, at the very least, by PayPal. So thank you very much, Stoyan. And next we have Cody, another previous subscriber who upgraded. So I wanted to say thank you for that. I thought it was worth mentioning here. Cody is in Frederick, Maryland, another place that has a very interesting history, especially during the 19th century and the Civil War. But I've been to Frederick personally several times because I used to work at a residential school. And during vacations and stuff, one of the duties that I had was to transport people. So I was actually in Frederick maybe, I don't know, a dozen times. And there is a Civil War medicine museum there. I remember in the same trip in Maryland, I went to, in Baltimore, they have the Museum of Dentistry. And in Frederick, they have the Museum of Civil War Medicine. Both are absolutely terrifying places. They're like haunted houses. So if you're ever in Fredericksburg, check out the Museum of Civil War Medicine. It's a good place to learn, too, about some of the things that have happened there in the past. Next, we have John, who lives in Louisville, Kentucky. And you might already know this, but you might not. Louisville, Kentucky is the home of Hillerich and Bradsby, which is the company that has made some of the most iconic baseball equipment in the history of baseball. I am talking about, of course, the Louisville Slugger baseball bat. Now, today, the company has gone on to produce other things like golf equipment and baseball gloves. But a very interesting story here. The way they came to make bats and became the best-known baseball bat company in the world was almost accidental. The story actually reminds me of a little bit of the movie The Natural with Robert Redford and Wilford Brimley and his diabetes. Yeah, Natural came out in the early 80s. Another fantastic movie if you like baseball. But the son of one of the founders of the company was at a game. The Louisville had a pro team at the time, and one of the stars broke his bat, and the kid invites the player to his dad's factory and makes him a new bat. But the partner in the company thought this was like a ridiculous waste of resources to make bats for baseball. What he wants to make, butter churners. How about that? Oh, Hillerich. He was so myopic. Good thing that Bradsby talked some sense into him. And Louisville Slugger is this very well-established name in wooden baseball bats, which are really only used in the major leagues and the minor leagues today. Every other kind of baseball uses aluminum or graphite bats. So that's Louisville. And then we have Kim, who is in Quebec City. We've talked about Quebec City before. But even after what I'm sure, I don't remember exactly what I said about it, but was a very thorough look at the history of Quebec City, here's something that you still probably do not know. The oldest English language newspaper in the United States was founded in Quebec in 1764. That is the Quebec Chronicle Telegraph. An interesting fact, because a lot of people in Quebec speak French. If you've been to Montreal, you know that there is a lot of French speakers in that particular province of Canada. That is not true as you go west. Quebec, very small city compared to Montreal, which is also in Quebec, about one-fifth the population. But if you're ever there, pick up a copy of the Quebec Chronicle Telegraph, the oldest English language newspaper in North America. So those are the new subscribers. I also want to thank Jonathan, who I mentioned before in an earlier version of this. He's in San Francisco, California. He actually wound up paying for the whole year, which I never even thought of that. What a great idea. That's very helpful, especially right now. I also want to thank Neil, who's in Dulles, Virginia, and Kenny, who's in Cape Coral, Florida, for their recent donations. And Rosalind and Thomas, who purchased the Ultimate History Lesson at tragedyandhope.com using the School Sucks coupon code. So again, my most sincere thanks to all these people. This was a long new subscriber geography trivia. Sorry about that. I'm going to try to make these a little bit shorter in the future. But thank you so much for listening. Thank you for your support.